I used to love my morning coffee until it stopped loving me back. The bloating, the discomfort, it just wasn't worth it anymore. Then I found Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's real coffee blended with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics. Now I get my morning ritual without the crash or the discomfort. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, you could win $100 cash or even get your entire order refunded. Head to everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and it's time for this week's One Last Thing. An interesting episode for you tonight. We're going to talk about where on the runway Malachi Starks and Mike Green are relative to our expectations. Joining me to do that is Brad McGowan. Brad, how you doing?
Ken, I'm doing good. I've been bemoaning the Ravens start and just getting my hopes back up, seeing guys come back to practice this week. A lot of injured guys coming back, and I'm hoping that they made some good changes during the bye, so we'll see.
A lot of players back, and Lamar Jackson, unfortunately, still limited at practice. There's one national pundit who's saying he may not play this week, but we're gonna talk about Starks and Green now, because I think they're an interesting pairing, a first and a second round pick, but I think we can agree it's one of the few times in Ravens history that they've gotten two players that they really believe are first round talents. And there are six times by my count that's ever occurred in a single draft. And sometimes it's been with two first round picks, as it was with Owe and Bateman in 2021. Other times it's been with a combination of a first and a second, which we'll talk about in other cases as well. But the last time it happened was in 2022, when the Ravens had Hamilton and Linderbaum. There are people who question whether Linderbaum was a wise first-round pick, but probably a first-round talent by most. And then David Ajabo, I think we'd have to include as a player that people thought at the time was a first-round talent the Ravens are getting in the second round.
Yeah, that in hindsight, it hasn't panned out, but I mean, you're right, Ken. Ajabo and Mike Green, who we'll talk about shortly, were both considered edge rusher talent. Edge rushers coming into the draft that were top 15 talents. Ajabo obviously had an injury, which made him less desirable in the draft, while Green had some off-field issues that teams were concerned about. The difference as far as play goes is Ajabo wasn't healthy to get on the field really that first year at all, and that really set him back. Green is in a much different case, but yes, you know, going back to the original point, Ajabo was a first-round talent that fell to the second round.
All right, we need to go through this a little quicker than that, but I'll say just Hamilton, a guy who did not play right away in his first year. And what one thing I wanted to get these pairings together was to see how many guys really jumped on the field, played right away, played a ton of snaps. How were they treated? Linderbaum did. Linderbaum played right away. He was a starter from day one. And Ajabo, of course, was NFI, as you mentioned, didn't really play at all in his rookie year, just a 20 or so snaps that whole season, including a bunch in the final game of the year when the Ravens weren't playing for anything. Owe and Bateman, both starters right away. Now, Bateman had an injury, but as soon as he recovered from that injury in week six, he was on the field playing a lot of snaps. So that wasn't an issue for him either. Owe played a very high percentage of snaps as a rookie. He's one of the odd ones, but played 57% of the snaps at outside linebacker as a rookie. And we'll get into that a little later, but that's a high total. Well, Hayden Hurst, first round pick. A lot of people didn't like the pick. I wanted Derwin James. It's a well-documented fact. But then Lamar Jackson, Ozzie, came back with that pick at number 32 in 2018. I really hate anytime you have to point to a pick and say, well, he also got Lamar Jackson, and you try and make up for a bad pick, like a bad systemic pick with a good pick. I really, really don't like that. But Hurst, they made the wrong pick. They got a guy who didn't help them as nearly as much as a Hall of Famer like Derwin James would have, or a future Hall of Famer like Derwin James would have. And Lamar Jackson, of course, potentially the greatest pick in Ravens history.
I am not going to argue with you in the slightest here. I hated the Hurst pick in the moment. I've told this story on one of your pods before. I was watching the Caps lose to the Penguins in the season. They would ultimately go on to win the Stanley Cup, but they ended up losing that game the night of the draft. And when they made the Hurst pick, I was so upset because Jackson was still on the board. They hadn't drafted James, and they redeemed the night with a Lamar pick. But to your point, it doesn't justify the Hurst pick.
Yeah, outstanding move by Ozzie to get back into the first round for that last pick. The Eagles were selling to the high bidder, and I can't believe the Ravens were the high bidder with only 2 seconds being the bait tangled out for that. I have to go back to 2003 before then, when the Ravens last got two first-round talents, quote-unquote, Terrell Suggs and Kyle Bowler. Now, Suggs, let's start with him. Obviously, went on to go to the Hall of Fame. But what percentage of snaps would you think Terrell Suggs played in his rookie year?
I remember him more as a situational pass rusher as a rookie. And you might have said this on a recent pod, so I believe it wasn't a high percentage, was it?
39%. So I had a really extreme ratio of pass snaps to rush snaps as a rookie. Actually, had a sack on his fourth NFL snap. But yes. that was in the 2003 game opener against the Steelers. They lose that game.
The Steelers, right?
Suggs, yeah. Suggs had the sack. And then Kyle Bowler, of course, probably more famous for dating Tara Reid than he was for anything he did at quarterback. He was a nervous squirrel coming out from under center. They seemed to like to play him under center so they could use play action and get things started. The problem was that the Ravens lineman footwork was terrible. Bowler's personal footwork was terrible. He really didn't have the first clue how to avoid getting tripped up or even losing the football, just doing the simple act of taking steps backwards. So Bowler, an awful pick for the Ravens. Looked at it today. He did end up with one more touchdown than interceptions as a Raven. It's like 45 and 44, 44 and 43, whatever it was. Not impressive. I mean, that's all you need to know are those stats. But you know, not all these picks worked out. Let's put it that way. Bowler was, unlike Suggs, a starter right away. So it shows you a lot of the immediate starting from those first round picks is need driven.
Right. Anyway. Yep.
Move on to the next group, which was in the 2000 year. Folks may or may not remember, but Jamal Lewis, they acquired the fifth overall pick in an unbelievable heist of the Atlanta Falcons during the 1999 draft when they traded their second round pick for the Falcons number one. The Falcons thought, we just went to the Super Bowl in 1998. We're going to finish, you know, in the top four or whatever. You're going to end up moving up six slots. We can trade you that in advance. And that ends up being the fifth overall pick. The Ravens get Jamal Lewis, and then they pretty well fumbled away the 10th overall pick on Travis Taylor, which was a bummer. So, but both of them started right away. Taylor did get hurt fairly quickly. Lewis was hurt a little bit right out of the gate, but still went on to for 1,364 yards that year. So certainly you'd call him a starter immediately. Then before that, of course, Jonathan Ogden and Ray Lewis, the first two draft picks in Ravens history, both Hall of Famers. And it's doubtful those heights will ever be scaled again, particularly in terms of who was your lesser draft pick among two. I don't think the Ravens will ever have two ones again where the second best also makes the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, the Ravens are celebrating their 30th anniversary this year, and it's odd to think that they will never have a draft as successful as that, first round of that first year.
Yeah. See, it is incredible for a team that doesn't trade up, generally speaking. They've had six separate occurrences where they've had two first-round picks. Yeah. And then this year,
but I will say that the Suggs Bowler year, I'm pretty sure that year they
did trade up.
They traded up to get Bowler. Yep. Yeah. And traded their first round pick.
And they of course did for Jackson as well. So they've done it twice in their history, but they haven't done it a lot in terms of what they've done. Most of the time they've traded back. They did trade up one spot to get Haloti Ngata famously. So that,
it
would have been a good one. But then thinking about the players this year, Starks drafted at, I think, 27, and then Green at 59. A couple of players who have started right away. They have played just about as much as anybody has on this entire list. Other than Linderbaum played every snap because he's a lineman. There's other players who played every snap at other positions like Ogden. Honestly, the two guys this year have been worked about as hard as anybody. We're going to get into that and whether or not that's mm-hmm. really a problem for these players. Any comments about this list before we go on to talk about how they dealt with the safeties that they've drafted?
I think something that's always interesting to me in looking at just going back and looking at the draft history, I think as fans, we often are caught up in the narrative of how good the Ravens are as a drafting organization, and they have been very good, especially compared to a lot of other organizations. But you can look at a lot of their drafts and see guys that did not pan out from what we hoped they would be. And there are a number of those guys on this list: Travis Taylor, Kyle Bowler, Hayden Hurst. You know, you could argue that Owe and Bateman haven't. I mean, they just traded Owe, and while Bateman is under a great contract, you could argue that maybe he hasn't lived up to that first round status. You know, again, it's just a good reminder that drafting and developing players is hard, and teams, you know, miss on guys all the time.
Yeah, the Ravens do not have a great track record of drafting and developing edge rushers in particular. That has been a problem for them, and we'll talk about that a little bit in the second part of the show. But let's continue on with the safeties bit. Now, the safeties that they've drafted, and I separated the guys they drafted the first three rounds from guys they got in later rounds. So the first three round guys are Reed, who started immediately, Hamilton, who was a part-time player immediately, didn't become a full-time player until the second season, which is surprising to a lot of people, but that's what it was. Elam, who started right away, and that just didn't play all that well. Tom Zibikowski, a third-round draft pick, who was a part-time player initially, did play some full-time for the Ravens when they had injuries, and played at free safety, in fact. And then a forgotten man now, Terrence Brooks, a part-time player who went on to play a few years in the NFL for other teams, the Jets and the Texans and whatnot, and not unlike Ed Reed, followed a similar path and went some other places, but was not really successful with the Ravens.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, like going back to the first round, the thing that we talked about, the first round picks where they've doubled up on this list, Ed Reed was the first safety they drafted. And he's, you know, Hamilton is off to a terrific start, but Ed Reed is the best there was, especially as a free safety. So, you know, again, like you set the bar high to begin with, it's hard to live up to that sometimes.
Well, I mean, it's true that Reed, Hamilton, and Starks are the three guys they've ever spent any true high rat. No, Elam. They spent draft capital on. So yeah. those are the four guys, and obviously one of them didn't work out very, very, you know, spectacularly, and the rest of them all look like they might work out. Reed's in the Hall of Fame, and Hamilton looks like he might be headed there. And you know, if we're talking about our Sarks, we don't know yet, and we'll talk a little bit about where he is relative to the runway in a few minutes. But the safeties they got in lower rounds. Now these guys are worth noting because Ozzie had a gift for finding value safeties late in the draft. Ralph Staten was a starter for the Ravens, a seventh round pick. Chad Williams, part-time player, actually started some for them too, but a great dime back, particularly in that 2002 season with the Ravens. Jerome Sapp, another really good dime back for a period. They lost him to the Colts, they got him back, but he was very valuable in 2006 in particular. Fairly limited role as a dime back plus special teams. DeJuan Landry started immediately as a fifth round draft pick. Will Demps started immediately as an undrafted rookie. Okay, that in 2002, need and a little bit of talent were at intersection there. And Will Demps getting a starting role next to Ed Reeve was a pretty big reach for the Ravens, but they made it work fairly effectively, I'd say. Haruki Nakamura, never more than a part time player with the Ravens, so he cashed in and played a little bit more with Carolina. Chuck Clark, you know, a green dot player for the Ravens, whatever you think of him, sixth round pick, part-time player to start, had the Ravens' greatest ever dime back season in 2019. You know, frankly, I thought was a pretty savvy trade pickup for the Jets. And then he just couldn't stay on the field with them. Geno Stone, a seventh round pick, looked like a steal at the time. PFF had him rated as the 53rd best player, I believe, that year in their draft handbook and whatnot. Ridiculous overrating, but he was a valuable split field safety. and he eventually came in his own with the Ravens, earned a big contract with the Bengals. And thank you, Cincinnati, for picking up the tab on that at the right time. And then Sanusi Kane, the last of the seventh round picks, that they got a part-time player right away, probably never will play a significant amount of safety for the Ravens based on the people that had jumped the line ahead of him this year.
Yeah. And to me, the thing that jumps out most in this group of guys is that in the later rounds, they've been more likely to hit on a strong safety type, special teamer, dime back type than a true free safety.
Oh, yeah.
Stone was a true free safety, and I believe Nakamura was more of a free safety than a strong, but you know, neither of those guys, I think, as you've seen how Stone has done in Cincinnati, neither of those guys held up without like a really solid to elite player next to them. When Stone was here, he was part of that three safety tandem that had Williams still playing at a high level,
yep,
and Hamilton in the box doing Hamilton things, and he got to just live off of overthrows. So, you know, I think the point I want to make here when it comes back to Starks is that free safety is one of these positions secretly that is kind of a premier position that you have to pay real money to get someone that can really lock down the back end in these complex coverages that teams run these days.
And the Ravens have done it on three separate occasions since about 2015, picking up Eric Weddle. I'm trying to remember what Weddle's first year with the team was. It was 2015, 2014, whatever it was. Weddle was brought in kind of after
16. 16, 17, 18 were his three seasons.
And then they cut Weddle, I believe, after 18 as part of a semi-cap purge. And they went out and they got Earl Thomas for 2019. And then he had a very tumultuous year in Baltimore, finishing with some he just couldn't be bothered to come to the facility on time because he was washing his car. If you're going to make an excuse for not being at work, at least come up with a reasonable excuse. Yeah. My sister is ill. I got a phone call. I had to take it kind of thing.
Yeah.
It should be untraceable. And it should be nothing having to do with, you know, I was polishing up my diamonds or I was having my car washed.
Yeah.
anyway, and then they went out and they got Marcus Williams, a huge contract to spend on him afterwards. And I think that the Ravens probably have, just to make your point for you a little bit, they've decided they need to get that in the draft, the free safety skill set. They went after one of the truly highly touted players in this draft, in Starks. And Malachi probably has not worked out to the level that the Ravens have hoped. He's also been thrust immediately into a starting role at a very difficult position to succeed at. So we're going to talk a little bit about that as we go ahead. But the key thing about all of these players, and the reason I made these lists, was to show that it's not necessarily all about talent, why these guys got their opportunity. A lot of it was need in these cases. And even if you look at Ruben Lowry this year, and you know he was thrust into the starting lineup on a need basis and ahead of Kane to do so. So it's, you know, we've seen some very interesting things. Geno Stone, a lot of the Dimeback picks, it was more of a natural evolution for some of these guys. Chuck Clark, I'm not sure that him being thrust into the lineup should have been anything that surprised people as a sixth round pick, but he was a Dimeback who graduated to being the starting strong safety and green dot holder during 2019 when the Ravens rebuilt their defense on the fly. So Tony Jefferson, another safety they went out and got, not a free safety, but a strong safety. They went out and got him, paid him a lot of money, gave him the green dot temporarily, and then he got hurt, and then it had to be Clark. And then Clark ended up really being the right guy for that 2019 defense to hold it together.
Yeah, the other, you know, I went ahead as part of this exercise, you know, because I had it in my memory that once Ed Reed retired, it felt to me, my experience as a fan, that they really had trouble solidifying the back end consistently. And I wrote down, you know, the starting pairs from 2013 all the way through 2022, which is when Hamilton joined the club. But through that time, I mean, they had a new free safety nearly every year until they brought in Eric Weddle. And he held it down for 2 to 3 years because in that first season, 2016, Lardarius Webb actually played most of the free safety, quote unquote, snaps, and Weddle filled the box more. But either way, you know, my point here is that they just were rotating guys in and out, trying to find that right group to solidify that back end. And I, you know, as a fan, anecdotally thinking about that time, it did feel like the play between the linebackers, second and third level in the middle of the field, that always gave them trouble.
Weddle is a strange cat. You know, he was here for long enough for you to know, but they had a special call for season ticket holders only that you could ask questions of Eric Weddle and the tight end Ben Watson. And the two guys were on the phone, and the difference between them in terms of comportment and leadership is like the Grand Canyon between them. Watson, cerebral, very composed player. There's a slight religious twang to some of the things he would say, but honestly, he's just very mature and adult as a person. Weddle, it's like he was giggling about every question. And not only that, one of the first times I saw him at practice, he was deriding the offense by saying, "Hey, offense, you look like the Bad News Bears out there. Hey, we're playing the Bad News Bears," kind of thing. And I didn't even see who was saying it. I turned to Sandusky, I'm standing next to you on the sideline, and I said, "Who's saying that?" And he goes, "Eric Weddle." And I said, that is the worst person imaginable to be riding your offense like that. I mean, it's okay to have one snipey little comment once in a while, but it should be pithy and it should get right to the point and it should dig and hurt and not have to be repeated to be said. But Suggs was great at that stuff. He would just, he'd have one very humorous comment per practice, but that was really hard to watch happen. I think probably somebody had to talk with him about that. But Weddle, in a lot of ways, he'll be on an interview or something and he'll project more maturity than I think he might have really had in real life. And then what do they do? They go out and they get an even more immature free safety in Earl Thomas after that.
Oh, man. Yeah. Oh, it was, I mean, you know, again, like they Ed Reed held that position down for so long. They really struggled to fill it once he retired.
All right, let's talk about what Starks has done so far this year. He leads the Ravens in defensive snaps right now. He's only missed six snaps all season. So he's jumped right into that role. One of the things in going through the lists of players is that positions like safety, corner even less so, because the Ravens have done some rotation at corner in the recent Harbaugh years, the last decade or so. But at safety in particular, they have no problem throwing guy out there for all the snaps in his rookie year. And they did that with Starks, and they've done it with other players like Reed in the past. And if you've got a player you believe in, you can, it's like playing an offensive line position. You can have him out there for every snap. But yeah, the results, I wouldn't say, had been all that good. 11.0 yards per target, 150.9 passer rating against, two touchdowns and zero interceptions. A lot of things are breaking down around him. But I guess the first question I would have is, do you think Starks would have somehow been served better by a rotational role?
It is really hard to say, Ken, when you draft a guy like Starks and you think he's going to be playing in a defense with Kyle Hamilton next to him, with Marlon Humphrey coming off a Pro Bowl season on one side, you have Nate Wiggins, who's ascending on the other side at corner. You have guys like Awuzie and Jair Alexander, known commodities on the outside, to play in coverage. And you have Roquan patrolling the middle. You think, like, in my mind, as a putting together a team, you think you could put Starks on that field, and he's not going to have to cover up for those guys, because they're going to know where to be, when to be, and they're going to, you know, help him get his bearings. And the reality has been like almost the literal opposite, that he's the adult in the room, unfortunately, as a 22-year-old, I think he's 22-year-old rookie back there trying to keep everyone else in line as everything else is falling apart. And so, you know, in that scenario, I don't know that any rookie is really going to be able to stand out. And so it's really hard to separate what's going on around him from, you know, his performance, because the whole defense has been underwhelming.
I think that's very fair in terms of that. It's very hard. In particular, what happens between level two and level three is something he has responsibility for. But going back to my original questions, was would he have been better suited by a rotation role? I don't think so. I really believe in his case, the correct answer is drink out of the fire hose, even if it means you occasionally get some water up your nose. And he's had a little bit of that certainly so far here. But the Ravens drafted him to be a free safety ball hawk. He's played almost exclusively on the back end. That doesn't mean they rushed the passer with him like four or five times. I'm not talking about that. Ed Reed did that too. And I'm not talking about him occasionally coming up and stuffing the run, which he hasn't been bad at all. I'm okay with that. But they would now have an opportunity if they want to make a choice to have Gilman back there as a free safety on every play or have him on some plays be the free safety who stays in some base plays, be the free safety who stays in with Hamilton. Or if there are games where they have the slot receiver is too much for Hamilton, that they have to put in a slot corner again, that Hamilton might play on the back end and you might see rotation between a Gilman and a Starks. I still don't believe that's the right answer. I think you fish with your number one pick and you see what he is as far as you can in this first year. And Starks doesn't have a long history of playing free safety in college. He was a multi-positional guy, you know, really got the Ravens' attention by being cerebral. Where do you shake out on that? Is there a reason to play Starks less now?
I don't think so. I don't think there is any reason to play him less. I think the only reason I would see is if the rest of the defense shores up with Gilman and Hamilton and you see him blowing coverages and you're in, you know, the Ravens are in a place where they're in contention and they just want to take a little bit off his plate. But I don't think that necessarily leads to less playing time. I think it might lead to fewer responsibilities. A couple of the things that like give me hope for him is, you know, again, we've talked about how he's been asked to cover up a lot of mistakes in front of him. You know, we also talked about Hamilton not even being a full-time starter his rookie year. And in fact, blew some, like had some big really game. Noticeable gaffes that led to losses. And it wasn't until now for Hamilton, maybe going back to your point, once they put him in the slot his rookie year and just asked him to defend that role and play downhill, he, you know, he totally blossomed. But that's never really going to be Starks' game. Like, he needs to be that back end guy, I think, especially given his cerebral profile. So, and like, as I've watched him, to me, he just seems like a half step slow in recognizing what is going on and reacting to it. And to me, like, he just needs reps to solve for that. And as he just gets more and more comfortable with what he's seeing in the speed of the game, he'll be in that place to make plays. And so I think you just got to leave him out there and trust that he's going to, you know, the football instincts are going to kick in once he gets a little, you know, just a little more seasoning.
Yeah. First of all, I completely agree. I don't think there's a reason to take him off the field. I think you run with the guy who could help you long-term. Gilman won't be here next year, almost certainly. If he is, you know, he'll be a market value guy. It may or may not. They'll do it because it's the right play with Starks and Hamilton, not because Alohi Gilman by himself is more valuable than Starks. It won't be because of that. So the other thing that I think is really important in terms of Starks' growth is that, yes, there's a lot of crap going wrong around him. There's a lot of things happening, not just at inside linebacker, which is a problem for a lot of deep safeties, but there's problems on the outside too, where he's going to need to get over and help in coverage. He's going to need to learn how to play loose bracket and whatnot. There's no solution for this problem that doesn't involve Starks improving his own playmaking to bring up the quality of play of those players around him, as opposed to the other way around. The gains that they can get from the inside linebackers dropping a little deeper and helping with the handoffs to Starks are small. The gains they can get from Starks being properly positioned to take advantage of overthrows or to make tackles on the plays that do get between L2 and L3, those gains are big. And so that's where Starks needs to be the better player. Instinctively, he's got to grow as a safety to be able to get to the outside from the high post where he can to help. Sometimes that'll be just to make a tackle, and sometimes that'll be maybe to pick off an overthrow if he reads the play well enough. But it's Starks himself improving his own playmaking is the way he improves his value. It's not by a bunch of other players playing better to make Starks look better than he has looked so far.
Correct. Yes, I agree with that.
Anything else about Starks before we move on to Green?
I don't want to beat a dead.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Of course here, but, you know, Hamilton is the second best player on the team after Lamar, in my opinion. And again, like he struggled the first half of his rookie year. Let's give Starks some runway here.
I don't think anybody is saying sit Starks because of what's happened. I think there are people, because I know of one sitting in this seat right here that I'm pointing to, my own,
that thinks they made the wrong call.
That thinks they made the wrong call and should have taken Emmanuel. So yeah. I'll bring this up again. Emmanuel right now looks like Kyle Hamilton with an extra 0.25 of, or with a 0.25 less of 40 time.
With a higher Madden speed rating. Yeah. Yeah. And I have not watched a lot of Emmanuel yet. And I think what they think Starks could become reminds them more of, with the cerebral nature of Ed Reed, who was able to, and I know, again, like you can't chase the past, but what made him so great was his ability to manipulate the look so that he baited the other team into making a throw that he was, the coverage dictated, but he was going to cover up on his own outside of the structure. And, you know, that's all cerebral.
He was an absolute sorcerer with regard to that. And, you know, he earned his spot on Tom Brady's wristband because of it. But the truth of the matter is, seeking that specifically out of Starks, that might take him years to get to a point anywhere near what Reed does. And then he'll never, you know, the interception Reed had, I think it was in the 2009 playoffs against Manning. He intentionally broke in the wrong direction, then with his back turned to the quarterback, broke back towards the football, and made the
interception. Was it 09 or an 06? It doesn't matter.
I think it's 09. I think the 06, well, it might have been 06. He did have at least one interception in the 06 game as well. I think he had maybe two in that game and one in the 09 game, but Manning was just shaking his head. And, you know, he's just like, I can't believe it.
And again, what I just did right there, comparing a current player to growing into a guy that you want before, like that's a bad draft analysis if that's their thinking. But as me on the couch, like as I'm thinking about, like, what did they see in the mental makeup, it's probably something that reminds them of what Ed Reed brought. So
all right, well, I certainly, we all hope that Starks works out here and takes it to a different level, and a lot of it's on him, and he's got a lot of time. Nobody's taking that position away from him anytime soon. Even with the level of play he's had so far, he's not going to lose it this year. And I don't think he'd lose it for a good portion of next year if he was playing at that level. The Ravens have to hope he comes around and gets there. All right, let's move on. Talk a little bit about Mike Green here. So first thing we're going to do the same thing. We're going to look back at the outside linebackers the Ravens have drafted. It is a long list, much longer than the list of safeties they've drafted. And I'm trying to hold it to the guys they've drafted in the top rounds, not the guys they've drafted late, although some of the successes you kind of can't help but talk about. They have not drafted a lot of guys, by the way, beyond round five at outside linebacker or defensive end or however they might label it within Pro Football Reference, which is kind of interesting. But The round one and round two guys, and I'm going to try and make sure I get all these, are Suggs, who played 39% of the snaps as a rookie. Owe, 57% of the snaps as a rookie. Tyus Bowser, 15%. Kamalai Correa, 5%. Courtney Upshaw, a little bit of a surprise here, in 2012, played 65% of the snaps. Paul Kruger, 17%. And then Kindle, 0%. And he was out that entire year. And Dan Cody, 0% as well in 2005, the year he was drafted. He came on and played 14 incredible snaps in 2006 that were his entire Ravens career. So an interesting crew there. I'm trying to see if there's any twos that I've missed here. Kruger, Kindle, Upshaw, Correa, Bowser, Ajabo. We didn't talk about it. Ajabo played essentially 1 or 2% of the snaps in his rookie year. Would have been the other one. So it has not worked out. Obviously, they have some bad names on the list of round one and round two picks. But I'm also trying to figure out, you know, how much did the guys
did Boulware not make? Oh no, you said the 4-3 era. I see this. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So yeah, Boulware is on there. Yeah, they have two more guys from the 4-3 era who I didn't include on this list because they're not exactly the same, but they were outside linebackers then. And Peter Boulware is the big one, a complete freakish outlier, but played 98.5% of the snaps in 1997.
That's crazy.
Incredible. Yeah. And Cornell Brown that year, who was drafted in, I think, the sixth round, played 35% of the snaps. And he's one of the only guys they've ever taken late. Yeah, he was in the sixth round. They think Dwayne Missouri was in the seventh round. There's a name from the past that some people from Hard Knocks. He didn't make the team, but ended up being an arena league star. Anyway, and the other guys, the point about these guys that they've taken in the early rounds is that, with the exception of Suggs, who played most of the downs for a very long time, the Ravens have always really been a rotational team at that outside linebacker spot. So nobody's playing more than about 2/3 of the snaps. And a lot of players are playing less than that, or they have a specific role. The other thing about it is most of these guys started out as situational pass rushers. Very much true of Suggs. His ratio was, I think, 2.5 to 1 in his rookie year of pass snaps to run snaps. Owe had a good percentage as well. And who's the other guy? Upshaw played a lot of run snaps as a rookie. He's unusual. Kruger, I think, was 5 to 1. And Suggs might have been in that range too, actually. I don't think he was 2.5 to 1. I'd have to go back and look at it again. That's information I've got on my spreadsheet, but I don't have it up.
Yeah, you mentioned it in a pod recently, but yeah, he was. And the other thing that stands out to me just looking at this list, Suggs had 10 sacks his rookie year, I believe. Well, 12 sacks. Yep. Yeah, so he's the only guy that hit double-digit sacks. And frankly, like, I don't think any of these guys made. Did Owe make a contribution in much as a pass? I mean, I know he.
Oh, yeah. No, Owe's very good as a rookie.
Yeah. I know he was good as a rookie, but he didn't have. He only had 6-7 sacks, 8 sacks?
I'll get you the thing. I think it was five and a half.
I know he had it. He came on really strong at the beginning of his rookie year, and for a while in that season, 5 sacks. Yeah, for a while in that season, they were going with a 3 outside linebacker rotation. They didn't have a whole lot of bodies, I recall, at one point that season.
Well, they had 5 sacks from Owe, but he also had 3 forced fumbles and 2 fumble recoveries. So that's a very impactful season from Owe, particularly given the even for 57% of the snaps. I mean, if you're an Owe hater after a season like that he had, I got no words for you. I mean, there's literally no discussion we can have that I'm going to be able to, you know, talk football with you and we're going to feel satisfied with the conversation, because you're going to hate everything I have to say. And I'm going to think you're an idiot for not understanding that Owe contributed an awful lot as a rookie.
Right. And as we're, you know, thinking about as this build up and intro relates to Green, I think, you know, the what I am thinking about is I think the sentiment in the fan community is that Green is really underwhelmed from what fans hoped he would be, given that he doesn't have any sacks at all. But I wanted to point out that, one, a lot of these guys don't come in with a dominant counting stats their first year. And Suggs is he up for the, he made the Hall, right?
No, he incredibly did not make it in his first year, and he should make it this year. We'll see how it works out. But he and Yanda both made it through to the next round. That just happened today.
Yeah, okay, that's right. That's what I had heard today. And the other thing about Green that is the big, the big point I want to make as we go through some of these details is he is playing in a far more extreme role than I anticipated, even more so than Starks. I don't think it's outside of the realm of what we thought going into the season that Starks would play nearly every snap. We kind of anticipated that. Green, on the other hand, is playing far more than we expected in a role far different than we anticipated as well, which is really interesting right now.
Yeah, I would have put a likely cap on his snaps at maybe 50% for the year. And I'll have to look back at the expectations episode, because there I'm not delphying with myself to think about how much, with the foresight already understood, the event already having occurred. But I think I might have put him at 50%, 45% of the snaps. I did expect a situational pass rush role. I expected them to really ease him in to this kind of a situation. It's been anything but that. They have not only have they fire hosed him so far, but it's going to get worse. I mean, Tavius Robinson is going on IR today. If he hasn't already, he has to go on IR for Emory Jones to be activated.
Yes, I think that happened today.
Okay. So it should have, because the 21-day window ended today. So it really had to. But anyway, the point I'm making there is, whatever you thought, I mean, and he'd already played, Tavius had played the most through 5 weeks when he was healthy of any front five defender by about 80 snaps. And that's going to completely change. I mean, very, very quickly, Mike Green will take over as the leader in snap count for that group. And it's a lot will be asked of him in terms of playing rundowns and whatnot. And I think he's a very different player in terms of Starks. And this is interesting to have them too, because the juxtaposition is nice here. Starks, the best thing for him is to play every single snap.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't believe for a second this is the best thing for him to play every snap. I think it's hurting his production. I think it could probably hurt him as a pass rusher to be trying to learn how to rush the passer when he's a little more tired than he will be in the future years. I don't like it.
Yeah, I also don't like... It's again, like juxtaposing him with Starks, it's hard to put someone on the back end in Starks' role and just isolate him to just doing his role. The back end, you are accountable for so much of what the rest of the defense is doing and coordinating a lot of what needs to happen in the secondary from his position at free safety. Green, on the other hand, he could ideally be put in a role where the only thing he has to worry about is just what's right in front of him. Like, get after the quarterback in a third and long, second and long situation. We're going to set you up, actually do some creative things to get you free runs. He hasn't had any of that. He's not received one pick play from a linebacker blitzing in to take over the tackle so he can loop around. They haven't run any stunts. They haven't overloaded a blitz on his side so he gets a free one. Vannoy got a sack that way where he got a free run on the overload, but I haven't seen any of that from Green. And instead, like, he's taken on so much more responsibility to account for so many more things simultaneously. It's so surprising that they've deployed him to some degree in this manner from day one and ramped it up, as they reduced OA snaps before they traded him and before Robinson got injured. It's just been really interesting.
With OA and Robinson gone, it makes very clear that the rush linebacker for the Baltimore Ravens is Mike Green, and the Sam linebacker for the Baltimore Ravens is Van Noy. And they could try and get Green to do a little bit more. Green hasn't been particularly great in coverage so far. He looked good in camp. I thought maybe there'd be something going to Sam. I think the best place now is just screw that. Let him try and learn the rust position. Don't try and if you can just take him off one learning thing, it would be taking him out of the, trying to learn that Sam role and some of the coverage drops he needs to do. Just his job is simplified greatly if all he has to do is beat the left tackle. It's not an easy job, but it's a simple job in terms of things that he needs to do. He's just now it then becomes about his pass rush bag of tricks and what he needs to do on a typical rundown to set that edge as properly as he can versus a much bigger man.
Yeah, and in the preseason, he showed in the short times he was on the field, he showed so many different looks as a rusher coming off the edge where, you know, he would dip inside or he'd go hard around the edge and get low. There was one rush against the Cowboys where he actually juked inside and then pivoted outside, which is something that I frankly hadn't seen a rusher do, and got there just a split second before the pass, after the pass got off. But I haven't really seen any of that creativity in his pass rush game during the regular season, which makes me feel like either he has primary responsibility. And this is something that let me actually back up. One of the things that we've talked about, that I've heard you talk about a lot, and we talked about in the how do they backfill for Oway pod that we did the last time I was on, is what their pass rush plan likely was over the first six games, knowing they would be playing such high level quarterbacks and quarterbacks that could specifically dominate blitz looks. And so perhaps they played a more conservative rush game, anticipating that they would need to hold lanes and they would be able to cover up on the back end. Whether that worked or not, you know, I think we all know that it didn't really work. They're 1-6 now. That being said, or 1-5. That being said, I wonder if coming out of the bye, knowing their schedule gets a bit weaker and they'll play weaker quarterbacks, that they will allow the pass rush and guys, and they will allow Green to just tee off and pin his ears back a little bit more, as opposed to having responsibility for holding a pass rush lane and then trying to get to the quarterback and just let him rip it and try different moves.
Yeah, I mean, two factors. One is quality of the quarterback, ability to read hot. And the second one is the mobility of the quarterback will be a factor. So probably they'll let him, you know, net have more ability to rush the passer and just get free to do it. I think the Ravens would be well suited against mobile quarterbacks, at least to use a spy and not try and hold off their pass rushers in the same way, to try and contain some pocket against, particularly against quarterbacks who like to hold the ball too long. Tua comes to mind as a guy who might be amenable to that, or vulnerable to that, I should say. Let's talk about a few other things in the Green thing. He's Ravens also played a ton of defensive snaps so far. So it's not just that he's playing a high percentage. He's playing 42 snaps per game so far as a rookie, which is on pace for the most outside linebacker snaps played by any Ravens rookie in the 3-4 era. And he's played, you know, he'll play more snaps than all but a few of Suggs's top seasons. He'll have more snaps than Upshaw had in 2012, for example, not including the playoffs, because Upshaw probably beats him with the extra, you know, 250 or so playoff defensive snaps they had. But with what he gets during this year, if he stays healthy and plays as much as he has so far, which I think is possible given just how weak the Ravens are right now at outside linebacker, then he'll play the most of any rookie in the 3-4 era. I'll say that he's also played almost half run snaps this year. Now, there's a couple things going on here. First of all, Ravens haven't been as dominant as they have in the past. They faced more total run snaps than Ravens teams typically do. When you lose games, the other team runs a lot more, and they've faced a lot of that. They've been unsuccessful stopping the run, and he's been a factor in that, but he's also played almost as many run snaps as he has pass snaps. That is so counter to the way all the other Ravens rookie outside linebacker types were handled. They're all situational guys. Kruger and Za'Darius Smith played 38% of the snaps, had a big pass to run relationship, and Ferguson played 52% of the snaps. There's another need guy who was in there for a fair amount. Mm-hmm. But he played a lot more pass snaps than run snaps in Oway, of course. So none of this really makes a lot of sense in terms of usage, but it's all need based. The Ravens are saying, yeah, but we have a hole that we need to fill, and he's the best player to do it, even though he might lose something as a pass rusher. And they're probably right on all those counts. It's just, it is not ideal for his development, in my opinion, to be playing so many snaps.
I agree with that. I agree with that last point. And, you know, we said this on the Oway pod that we did on how they backfill him, that going into the season, if you would have, I would have thought their roles would have been flipped. I would have thought Oway was going to be the guy they leaned on to help them set up the third and long. So he was the guy that was going to set the edge. He had the experience. He was bigger and stronger this year. And he would get his fair share of pass rush snaps, but he would be playing 2/3 of the snaps. And Green, as an example, would be playing 1/3. And instead, they came out almost immediately in the inverse. And Oway was immediately made the situational pass rusher, which was really odd.
Yeah, I thought that was odd too. He said Oway has, in his snaps with the Ravens, almost a 4-to-1 relationship of pass to run, by the way, so far for the year. So that would be much, that'd be almost exactly what I'd expect. 3-to-1, maybe even for a rookie guy with a high pass rush pedigree. I mean, there's nobody who comes with any higher pass rush pedigree in Ravens history at outside linebacker other than Bull Wearer Suggs. Those are the only two guys who have a higher pedigree than Mike Green. It's very unusual how he's been used. I guess here's my question. Would you expect the Ravens would, first of all, probably do a multiple set of things to reestablish more outside linebacker depth for next year? Look at Tavius back, which is just part of the picture, but Van Noy will be gone. So they're going to have to draft a player. They're going to have to sign a player. They may double dip at the position in terms of that. That's worked out so well in the past, you know, with Correa and whatnot, Kelfusi and players like that.
Yeah.
But if assuming they do double dip at the position or they, you know, get one from multiple sources, maybe they have a guy they like from like Malik Ham in the fourth year, they like him all of a sudden because he plays well this year, or they draft a guy and they sign a veteran guy as well. Do you see a possibility that Green could revert to being more of a situational pass rusher next year?
Gosh, I would think they'd need to bring in a couple established veterans in order for that to happen. Otherwise, he's probably going to be the highest pedigreed, the most experienced guy they have after Tavius. Like, there's not really unless they get like some seasoned veteran that has a lot of snaps in him. You know, frankly, like he's probably going to be their best bet.
Right. They almost need a run specialist on early downs to avoid him being a guy that they have to lean on heavily. And I don't know if this would work. It probably wouldn't. They probably need somebody else who's more of a 270-pound outside linebacker who is an occasional kick inside guy, could also play five tech, but is more comfortable, you know, putting
like a Pernell McPhee type.
Pernell McPhee be ideal in those terms. Yeah. Courtney Upshaw, you know, was not bad. I mean, he was bad in his time with the Ravens. He had more personal fouls than he had sacks in his career with the Ravens, which there you go, that's enough. But
he did force a fumble in the Super Bowl though. And big fumble. That's all that matters. Well, the thing about a guy like that though is that is the kind of, they could probably get a guy like that in the later rounds. I mean, that's where they've gotten Zadarius. That's where they've gotten Pernell McPhee. That's where they've gotten Tavius. So, you know, that kind of guy they could. I mean, even we talked about Jalen Ferguson when he started playing a lot in his rookie season. Like, while he did play more pass rush snaps, like one of the things that I remember them leaning on him for, I remember this, I feel like it was the 49ers game in the rain at home, was helping to set the edge because they were really struggling to set the edge on rundowns. And so, you know, he was a pretty big body as well. So, you know, maybe they could get a guy like that later. I do want to go back to something that you said though, about the amount of snaps that he is playing and how much the Ravens defense has been on the field. As you said, that the thing to me that like the alarm bells went off in my mind is right now they have three outside linebackers on the roster that can play, like without a practice squad call up. Like I was certain that they were going to make a move to bring someone in or sign someone off the street.
Yeah.
And they haven't done it yet. I mean, they've signed a couple guys to the practice
squad. Why do you think that is? Because I have a theory. Why do you think that is?
I wonder, well, now that you have a theory, I could be way off, but I wonder if they have a deal that they want to make but they are waiting on the outcome of these next two games as to whether or not they pull the trigger.
Yeah, that's exactly got to be it. Because if the season is lost, there's no point in throwing good draft capital after bad. So they're going to try and get through this game. They think they have a way to get through this game somehow, whether it's Malik Ham, Brent Urban to the edge, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
They think they have a way to get through the Bears game and still contain what is a pretty potent running attack. But they've got four nose tackles and Brent Urban to try and play football with on the inside. It's going to be very interesting to see how they do that. Yeah. Unless they want to activate Aeneas Peebles, which they could do too.
Right. Yeah. Well, the one thing that I hope portends a better second, post bye for Green's performance is Roquan comes back. The Gilman trade has allowed them to play Hamilton down near the line of scrimmage in the box and on the edge. And having those guys, those veteran guys that the team can rely on, one, to make the run fits and to play downhill and aggressive. My hope is that also frees up Green to get after it a little bit more, knowing that there's, not that he is holding back because he doesn't have confidence in the defense behind him, but those playmakers around, close to the line of scrimmage are going to let some of the guys that are still working to establish themselves, get after it to a degree that they haven't been able to since the defense got off to such a poor start. That's my hope anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's a hope, and unfortunately it may be the only strategy the Ravens have right now to get through these next two games, because there's not an easy way, and dumping a ton of draft capital right now, I'm opposed to it. And meaning, if they end up trading a fourth or particularly a fifth round pick, I'm okay going that far in terms of trying to find the right players for 2025 and see if they can right the ship. And if they did so after the Bears game, I wouldn't have a problem with that, even though that's a very short week to try and assimilate somebody into your system.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of unlikely. By the way, that's the reason why I don't believe the Lamar Jackson talk. So there's one of the national pundits came out.
I saw that. Yeah.
And said that I'm talking to some sources close to the situation, and they think Lamar is going to return for the Miami game and not the
Not the Bears game.
Not the Bears game. I think that's completely.
And the Miami game's on Thursday.
Miami's game's on Thursday. I mean, obviously they're not going to bring a guy back on a Thursday. And the way that it would be talked up by someone is that, well, sure, then they give him extra time to recover from whatever happens in the Thursday beginning of his Miami. But no, you don't get it. It's too short an amount of time for him to come back. The difference in where he'll be physically is not enough. So he's either got to play this week.
Yeah.
I think he's probably out until week 9. Week 9, what was it? Week 7, week 8 is the Bears, right? Week 8 is the Bears, yes. And then week 9 is the Dolphins, so it'd be week 10.
Yeah.
He'd be playing again. So, and I think I share a lot of fears of Ravens fans that the season will be over by week 10 if Lamar does not play in week 8 or week 9.
Yeah, I agree with that. And to the point of maybe they have a trade that they want to fire off, depending on what happens in the next few games. I mean, I don't know if it makes any difference, but the two guys that are most notably available play for Miami, and they're going to be in Baltimore's going to be in Miami on next Thursday. So maybe they're waiting to see how that plays out. Then they'll get something done, but pure speculation.
Yep. Even after practice today, the Ravens holding steady at -6.5 versus the Bears. So, The gambling markets do not seem to have clarity about whether Lamar is playing or not. They didn't know before, and they still don't know, is how I would interpret that.
Right.
All right. Always great talking football with you, Brad. This is a particularly good episode, I think, because we're talking about two young players and two guys who are part of the future. Tell folks where they can talk football with you online.
I'm at MC Bradley, and I promise that if you tag me in a Twitter thread, it won't be a 20-minute podcast that turns into an hour-long podcast like this one.
We're sorry about that. Sometimes we like to make these ones short and bring them in pithy. This topic, particularly good one, I thought, and really worth the time to discuss two players who were critical to the Ravens in not only 25, but 26 and beyond. Thanks for listening. As always, best thing you can do for the show, tell one new person about them, show them the website, show them how to play the podcast directly from there, or just read the articles if that's what they're into. For Brad McGowan, this is Ken McCusick saying goodbye. We'll talk to you next time on Film Study.